Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast, the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guests this week, Chris DeWitt from DeWitt Communications and Sam Inglot from Progress Michigan, an old MERS alum. Glad to have you back, Sam.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kyle. Always good to be hanging back in the MERS office.
And then Chris, a longtime friend of MERS.
Yes, I always enjoy spending my Mondays here.
How did you get away with not being on the podcast before? You know, we've done this about 10 years, and this is the first time you've ever been on.
Just lucky.
This is an outrage. I can't believe you've never done this before.
I've been saving all this material, so it's going to be wonderful.
I think now that I think back on it, you do head for the stairs a little quicker, don't you? So that you don't end up having to do this that often.
I have avoided this very successfully, and now, but I'm trapped today.
All right. Well, good. We're going to appreciate your insight. We've got a lot to talk about, but the first thing we wanted to touch on was the State of the State address has been talked about quite a bit. The question I want to ask, though, is 35 minutes for a speech is something we haven't seen before. Okay, so this is a little unusual to have such a short speech. And I was actually thinking about this when I was in church yesterday. I was at a church I'm not usually at, and for reasons I'm not going to get into because it's too long of a story. But anyway, as I was sitting here listening to the sermon, and I thought, God, this isn't a Catholic sermon. Because if this was a Catholic sermon, it would have been done about 10, 15 minutes ago. And I thought, God, I really miss this. Brevity is really kind of nice. So I guess I bring this to the attention here of the folks here. 35 minutes for a State of the State address. Yes, it was short, but I would say short is good, Jack.
Yeah, like Mark Twain said, sorry for the length of this letter. I didn't have time to make it shorter.
Now, but one could argue, Chris, that a State of the State, you have an hour. Why not use the hour?
Having been involved in some of these in the past, you don't want to go too long, too short. You can certainly emphasize your points very easily in a shorter period of time. But there are subjects that don't get touched that you could have touched on. For example, and this isn't really a partisan one, the census. I don't believe she talked about that I remember during the speech. That's probably one of the most important things that are coming up, and that's something that could have been added. But for her main things, I think she did an excellent job with it.
It made me wonder if there are a couple things made me think about why it was as short as it was. Could it be that we're so crammed on the schedule with State of the State budget, and now we add the speech for the State of the Union response that they didn't have time to do more than 35 minutes? Or is it kind of a recognition that, you know, the Republicans aren't going to do a lot on my wish list anyway because this is a presidential election year, so why bother lay out a bunch of things that they're just going to shoot down and make fun of later anyway? So let's just limit the number of things we talk about and emphasize those.
I've got to believe that clearly there were more things that could have been brought up that they discussed, but I think they wanted to make the main emphasis on the points that were raised. And if you start going into other areas, you potentially lose some of that attention. And I think she wanted to make it very clear that, you know, for example, roads was going to be a top issue, and that's what she spent a lot of time on. And that made sense.
You have any thoughts on that, Sam?
No, I think you're onto something with the budget discussion being right around the corner. And I do think that she used the time pretty efficiently to talk about some topics that don't often get brought up, particularly looking at the issue of maternal health care through a racial lens, really hitting on, you know, she made some very broad strokes about income inequality and hit on really a number of issues from wage stagnation to paid time off, childcare, overtime expansion. So while it was a short speech, there were definitely some areas where she packed a lot in.
Let's face it, Jacob, the big discussions right now is surrounding the roads. And that's where she did spend a lot of time. And Chris has got a good point here. If you start splintering off on too many things, you lose the focus behind what folks are really talking about and what her main thrust of her administration has been since taking office, which is to fix the damn roads.
Yeah. And I mean, look at how her message gets distributed out by the media. When she said she wanted to focus on four areas, you know, roads, jobs, healthcare, and education. That makes it very easy for us to kind of not have to try to track down a million things and try to focus on every single theme. And so it really does help kind of condense down into the topic areas. And then, of course, she led off with roads and, you know, kept that on the front burner.
I got to tell you, I've always thought these were too long. I always thought they're the kind where your eyes kind of glaze over at a certain point. And the shorter, the better in a sense. I mean, I'm not sure you should cut it to 10 minutes, but she could shoot for under 30 next time. Getting answers to my questions afterwards, and I was going after the education angle, as you know, and I sure have an awful lot of road stuff on the tape recorder, because to me it was roads, roads, roads. You couldn't get the Republicans off of that topic, which indicates to me that maybe it was a winner for her.
Well, it was definitely a winner for the press. I tell you, covering a 35-minute speech is a lot easier than covering a one-hour speech. It's a lot less material to go through. So I enjoyed State of the State night more than I typically do, because I felt like it was a lot less to unpack, a lot less overwhelming, and I thought made for a better addition all around. Sticking on Rhodes for just a minute, Lee Chatfield's plan that he continues to talk about, and Mike Shirky has his own ideas as well, they're both going to be talked about. I'm not convinced, as we talked about last week, that we're going to have a lot of action on them. But as far as political pop, Lee Chatfield's position on making sure that all tax money collected at the pump goes to roads against Mike Shirky's idea of refinancing the teacher pension system and then drawing money out of that. Who has the better message, Chris?
Chatfield, in my mind. People are very, very sensitive to gas prices. They want all the taxes to go to the roads. It is a very strong message that he's got. There are a lot of issues, obviously, as far as if you change that, but the sensitivity to gas prices is very, very high. You know, I have, as a good Dutchman, I have an app on my phone that tells me the cheapest gas in the area.
Now, you are a good Dutchman. I think that's why you're here today, is because John Roerink, the other good Dutchman, isn't
right
here.
Right. It, just from a standpoint of people drive in and probably go past a half dozen gas stations every day and see the price. And people expect that money goes to the roads when, in fact, it doesn't. And so Chatfield's message on that is very, very strong. Now, there's a big issue. Obviously, if you take that off, if you do put it all towards roads, then what do you do to fill the void, especially for education? But people are less aware of their taxes that they pay for education. I don't know exactly how much I pay for property tax, for example. I don't know exactly how much I pay for income tax. And people are more willing to vote to raise a millage for education than they are on gas tax. I'm not saying it makes sense. I don't necessarily agree with it. But from a standpoint of where Chatfield's coming from, it's a pretty strong thing. And if there is to be an agreement between the various interests on this, maybe they can come up with a way to deal with that. And I think the public might be more willing to go along with it, especially, obviously, if there has to be a vote to whatever the change would be.
It seems to me that Chatfield has the more political catchy message, for sure. But if you're looking at the financial end of things, then maybe Mike Shirky's makes a bit more sense, because the numbers conceivably add up just as long as, the stock market doesn't completely crash, and then the state is actually out money as opposed to gaining money, Sam.
Me personally, I think that Chatfield and Shirky's plans aren't real solutions. I mean, anything that gambles with the teachers' retirements, anything that takes money out of the schools, I think is pretty much dead on arrival. But I think, again, I saw Chad Livengood tweet out the budget analysis of where money is coming in. And I think just a key piece of the conversation that's really missing from this revenue conversation is the lack of revenue from the business community. So I think that going forward, folks like Gretchen Whitmer, obviously, at Progress Michigan, we're going to be pushing this message. But, we really need to change the way that businesses and corporations in the state actually fund public services that we all rely on.
There's another thing somewhat going along with what Sam was saying that you got to keep in mind on the gas tax is we're moving more and more, not totally there yet, and it may be a long time, but we're getting away from the gasoline engine. And so that funding source is more at risk. So looking at some other avenues of revenue is going to be important.
You know, House Minority Leader Christine Gregg and the House Democrats had a transportation road funding plan, I think last spring at some point. And having the business community kick in more money into the roads was a major piece of that. And I was surprised that Governor Whitmer didn't go that route as far as trying to get either an increase in the corporate income tax or more money from trucks or something like that. But she hasn't, Jack. Has that surprised you?
Well, she'd just be posturing. She's got a Republican legislature to deal with. I think that's a no-go. So that would be a decision on her part as to whether to go after that. And remember, it's also in the context of her 45-cent gas tax increase, too. I mean, how much are you going to be asking for more from just a political messaging standpoint? And in adding to what Chris said about the automobiles becoming less and less dependent on gas, and so in the long term, is the gas tax really the best thing to be looking at in the future? I will say this, there's a certain messaging situation there where it's the richer people who have the cars right now that have better gas mileage also than those that are poorer people. So there's all kinds of dynamics to that. But the bigger the other question you mentioned was Chatfield. And I think the important part of that question is I think the Republicans better settle on what their message is going to be. And I think Chatfield's is the better one.
And then the last thing I want to touch on the roads, Jacob, as far as bonding goes, and you were at the State Transportation Commission meeting on Thursday, a point that you brought up to me that I think is worth emphasizing is how long this bond that she's going for is and how long the lifespan of the road is going to be that is going to be fixed or redone because of the bond.
Yeah, well, that's something I need greater clarity on as well, because the state was trying to make the case that with the extra influx of cash from the bonds, they're going to be able to go back and do some of the projects that I think they want to do in terms of rebuilds. And rebuilds are going to last longer than, you know, just filling in a pothole sort of thing. I'm not exactly sure how long they plan for these bonds to be out, as well as the life expectancy on these projects. But I think the governor herself mentioned, like, she's like, yeah, these projects are going to last a while, like 20, 30, 40 years. And I'm pretty sure the bond life is around 20, although I don't have that exactly. So there could be some questions, especially from opponents of borrowing money for the roads, as to, is this going to fix the problem? Some have already said that it's only going to exacerbate what we're seeing right now. So we might see people hit on that more as we go forward.
One thing I want to bring up is that I thought it was pretty clear that Governor Whitmer made the point to say this is not a long-term fix. This is something that will fix some of the worst, most highly traveled roads in the state. It is not a long-term fix. The legislature needs to handle that. And I think that Mike Shirkey and Lee Chatfield were really trying to make an effort to spin what she said into a long-term solution. The phrase, you know, this is not a long-term solution, she's being dishonest with the people about this being a long-term solution, that came up constantly within their press conference. And so I just thought that was kind of a somewhat disingenuous spin on what was very clearly an emphasized point in her speech, that this is not a long-term solution. But then the next day, Shirkey and Chatfield turn around and try to score cheap political points by claiming that. Yeah,
well, they didn't just hit it. They flat out said it over and over again.
Constantly. It was constant. And I thought it was very disingenuous. And I think we won't get to a space in the legislature, especially in divided government, where we can actually get a bipartisan long-term solution to fix our roads when two of the highest ranking members of the legislature are coming out, you know, 12 hours after a speech is made and just straight up lying about what she said.
All right, we're going to change subjects now. I want to talk about Friday being campaign finance deadline day. We had a very busy week last week. We're going to have a very busy week this week. But I don't want the campaign finance numbers to get lost in the shuffle, because there are some very significant things that we saw in there that I'd like to talk about. First of all, Alyssa Slotkin raising $1.15 million in this last quarter from October 1 to December 31st. That is U.S. Senate-like numbers. And just to put this in comparison, nobody came close to $1.15 million who's running for Congress in the state of Michigan. Justin Amash had a surprising $550,000. We'll talk about him in just a minute. And then Haley Stevens had $550,000. And then everybody else was in that $250,000 to $200,000 stratum. And then you had kind of the also-rans after that. But Chris, let's start with you here. What did that number tell you about Alyssa Slotkin?
She's going to win re-election. She's done an excellent job, not just on the money, but she has made it very clear that she covers the whole district. She spends, it certainly appears to me, more time in the district than her predecessor did. She's working the ground side of it real well. She's gained some national prominence, which is probably helped with her fundraising. And right now, she has no real top-level opponent at this point, and it's going to be real tough to beat her.
So you take a look at the Republicans in the field right now, and there's four, maybe five of them right now. Paul Young put in $130,000 of his own money. And after that, we're talking $6,000 raised, $3,000 raised, $2,000 raised. Sam, you add all that up and times it by 10, and maybe you get to what Slotkin's raising.
Yeah, I think Alyssa Slotkin has really played smart in her district, understood the makeup of it. You know, as a progressive myself, sometimes that has been, you know, I appreciate more of a firebrand type lefty, which Alyssa Slotkin is not. But I think that plays in the district. And I think that showing up has been a really big part of it. Even after the impeachment news where that she would be, you know, supporting that, she went out in front of crowds and spoke. And I think that really resonated with a lot of people. Anyone's going to have a challenge, you know, at this point catching up to that number. But I think we're actually seeing across the country that Republicans are struggling with some House candidates, from people deciding not to run again to not the best fundraising numbers. So I think, yeah, she's in a strong position come November.
You know, you don't raise $1.15 million for a quarter, Jack, without help from the national contributors. What does that tell you, Jack? That is
this is all part of her strategy. Last time she ran, it was the most money spent on a congressional district in the history of Michigan. The big money up front is her strategy. If this is really a 56% Republican district, this is what she's got to do, because it's a whole different ball game in 218. That's the midterm. Traditionally, the party out of power does well in the midterm. It was also a year when it was absolutely time for a Democratic governor. It was absolutely time for a Democratic attorney general. And it just historically, all the arrows were pointing that way. But this time, it's going to be more of a challenge, and this is exactly what she has to do, is have everybody saying, this is it, it's done, it's over, nobody can touch her. And that's exactly what she has to do to play this. It will be amazing, and it will be the Republicans' fault if they fail to put up a good race against her in if it is really a 56% Republican district.
I don't think it's a 56% Republican district anymore. Times are a-changing.
They may know that. All I'm saying is that's the last numbers we have.
Well, we'll see. But again, I think she is doing, you know, as we discussed, she's doing everything you need to do to be in a very, very strong position. And let me add, Stevens is doing the same, maybe to a little lesser degree, but she's also in a very strong position based on what she's raised and the level of potential opposition that she's got or looking at this point.
So at 11:45 p.m. on Friday of the campaign finance deadline day, on January 31st, who was the last person to sneak in their campaign report before the end of the day but our friend Justin Amash? And when I saw that come in, I'm like, boy, he just probably just laid a big lemon. I was waiting for $100,000, $50,000, something really putrid that would want him to put that number in really late so nobody would pay attention. And then, Jacob, he put in $550,000. Just a number that I wasn't expecting to see, but he came through with it. What does that tell you?
What maybe he wants to communicate is that he is taking this re-election seriously. He's not throwing the race away because he abandoned Republican Party. With a lot of these congressional seats and these fundraising, it's not so much a state game as it's a national game, and I'm sure he's getting national support as well from the people who support him and his way of thinking in terms of constitutional strict approach, libertarian type thing. And so, yeah, so I think he's showing that this is going to be a three-party race.
Republicans got to be really nervous about this. If Justin Amash can raise that kind of money, he's going to be a serious contender then. We've had on the board here for some time whether Justin Amash was going to run for Congress, was he going to run for president, is he not going to run anything at all. And this tells me, Chris, that he's running for Congress, and Republicans got to get serious about this, because if it's a three-way race, the Democrats could win this race.
Yeah, that territory that I'm very familiar with is changing. I mean, Kent County is moving. The city of Grand Rapids is a Democratic city. The Dems have the majority there. So if you've got a three-way race with Amash splitting off mostly Republican votes, the Democrats got a very, very legitimate chance of winning that seat. I think Amash's chances of winning are pretty slim, even with the amount of money that he raised, but he also annoyed a lot of people with where his stand is on Trump that are traditional Amash voters.
I got to correct myself here. Justin Amash raised almost $600,000, so even a little better than I had said. A couple of things that I want to mention, too, on the fundraising numbers. Peter Meyer raised $240,000, roughly. That's more than anybody else had raised in that congressional district. Lynn Afendoulis raised $100,000. Joel Langlois, who was supposed to be a top-tier contender, only raised $12,000, but he put in $400,000. Of his own cash. So he's going to have some money to throw around. And so, you know, even if he didn't raise any organically, he's still got some around. And I also want to say on the Democratic side, I think that among establishment Democrats, the thought is that Hillary Scholten is the front runner. She raised $125,000, but Nick Colvin, an attorney out of Ionia, raised $100,000. So he wasn't all that far behind. Sam, what's your thoughts on this race?
Yeah, so I think you have some interesting kind of things at play here, because let's be honest, the Republican message in 2020 is allegiance to Trump. I mean, it is, you know, their litmus test for candidates is how much do you love Donald Trump? How much do you kiss his ring? In a place like West Michigan, which Chris pointed out that, you know, demographics are changing, political leanings are changing, this three-way race of a, you know, Amash kind of going out on his own, sticking to his principles, and Democrats probably continue to talk about, you know, issues that affect folks like healthcare and water. And we'll see what the main message comes out from the Republican Party. But again, I would imagine it'll probably lean more towards that. How much do you love Trump? And I think West Michigan will be an interesting case of that message being tested.
So Peter Meyer, one of the candidates here in the 3rd Congressional District on the Republican side, put up a Super Bowl ad that aired on Fox during the Super Bowl. We're going to go ahead and listen to that ad, and then Jack, I'm going to get your response to it.
He's a battle-tested leader.
Congress is in chaos.
In Afghanistan, Peter Meyer brought order to chaos.
Washington is a disaster.
Meyer responded to disasters around the world.
Tensions are rising in the Middle East.
Meyer knows he interrogated terrorists in Iraq so he could handle Democrats in D.C.
Okay, enough of this drama. I'm a conservative veteran running for Congress because in uncertain times, West Michigan needs proven leadership. Text me if you agree. I'm Peter Meyer, and I approve this message.
Well, he's certainly hitting his background in the military, Jack.
Yeah, and that's not a bad place to start introducing yourself. And again, we talked about Lisa Slotkin, which she has this sort of background in the patriotic side, et cetera, et cetera. This is never really a bad place to start introducing yourself. But I still think that the part that the dynamic on this thing that is really the monkey wrench is the Justin Amash thing. I frankly am surprised at that amount of money that he raised.
Oh, well, it shows that he's got national support. I mean, he didn't raise that money in the 3rd Congressional District. This is from his Rand Paul, Ron Paul network of libertarian-leaning Republicans or just libertarians in general all coming to his aid. I mean, he must have sent out the SOS signal. I'm in big trouble here. And if you want me to stick around, you're going to have to open your checkbook.
Well, how many districts are there around the country where it would have been worth doing that with? That may be part of how he got this kind of money, is there just may not be that many other examples where somebody's an incumbent where it would be worth investing something.
There's one part of that ad that really I find offensive.
Please.
Comparing the people that he interrogated to Democrats, that's offensive.
Yeah.
And while that may be great for him in a primary, it's going to hurt him in a general election. That was, in my mind, was a mistake on his part.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the Hellfire missile John James ad. But again, the problem here is it doesn't actually speak to any issues that affect people. You know, there's rock music and there's camouflage and look, I'm tough and Democrats are terrorists. Okay, what is that, like Chris says, maybe in a crowded primary that could help separate you, but that doesn't really identify with what people are dealing with every day. They want to know, you know, how, you know, wages, healthcare, water, fixing infrastructure, and that ad hit on none of it.
Yeah, but if you're trying to look like a badass, that's the type of thing that you can connect with people who are going to vote for Trump anyway.
It may work for him in a primary, and he's got to win the primary. I understand that. But he's also got to then get elected in November. Winning a primary is great, but if you lose at the end, who cares?
Who doesn't vote for him because of that would have otherwise?
There is a moderate level of republicanism, I still believe, in Grand Rapids, the old Calvin College professor type. For those that know Grand Rapids, they produced a lot of elected officials on both sides, for those who really go back. It was an area that he didn't need to go to. He's got plenty of assets. I mean, what he raised, but he could probably, and I don't know this for a fact, but he could probably write his own check for $400,000 and put it into the campaign. Money's not going to be a problem for him. So he will be able to deliver a message, and I just think that was a misstep in my mind.
Well, and let's not forget here, West Michigan and the Dutch heritage in West Michigan are very big on being fiscally conservative and being frugal. And there's one thing you can't hit Justin Amash on, and that is he is fiscally frugal. And he will take a stand and will vote for something, even if it looks bad politically, because he doesn't want the federal government spending money in that certain way. So keep that in mind. I think that there is a certain population there in West Michigan who still appreciate those types of values.
But the trade-off is, for many people, and he stabbed Trump in the back.
Well, he absolutely. And that's absolutely good.
That's heresy for a lot of those folks.
I don't believe Justin Amash can win that district. That's why it's so interesting to see him, you know, raise the kind of money he raised, et cetera, and I'm not real sure how to evaluate all of how this is playing out.
Last thing I want to touch on here for our commentary portion. In honor of the Iowa caucus, which is going on today, and if you're listening to it later in the week, has already happened, Michigan is going to be kind of in the middle of the pack when we have our primary on March 10. And when March 10 happens, the field of today, which as we're taping on Monday morning, is of 11 candidates. By the time we get to March 10, this field could look much different, and it will likely be smaller. How much smaller will it be? And I'm going to ask the question of everybody, who is still going to be around as a presidential candidate when we vote on March 10? And I'll start with Chris, since he's looking at the list.
All right, Sanders, Biden, Bloomberg, Warren, maybe Mayor Pete, maybe Senator Klobuchar, Gabbard, Yang, Steyer, Bennett, Patrick, doesn't matter if they're in or out.
All right. What do you think, Sam?
I think of that list, I think by March 10th, Bennett and Patrick are the two that drop out. I think everyone else sticks around.
All right. Jack, what do you think?
Well, I don't think this is very much different than what Chris said. I just think it's still going to be an awfully large field. I don't know who's going to drop out, maybe one or two of them. But the way this is playing out right now, I think an awful lot of people are going to still think they have a chance.
All right. What do you think, Jacob?
Well, in terms of who's going to be around and who's actually competing, those are two different questions. I'm going to go with a very safe answer and say that by the time we vote, you're going to at least have the big four, who I would term as Sanders, Biden, Warren, and Buttigieg. And then the two late, more late entries that have a lot of wealth, so Bloomberg and Steyer.
Okay. I should mention this. Don't forget about whoever maybe overachieves unexpectedly someplace. That's always a big, and you can finish fifth, but if you overachieve, you get a lot of interviews, et cetera. So there could be somebody in there that's sort of hidden that we don't know about.
All right, I'm going to give a drastically different answer. I think that the field will be very small. I think we're going to be at four people. I think it will be Bernie, Joe, Bloomberg, and I'm going to say Bennett. And the reason I say Bennett is because he doesn't seem to be campaigning anyway. So it seems like he's got a longer term play. Like, I think he's going for like a brokered convention type thing where he can come in and be like a moderate person or somebody different that could win in a convention.
Willing to put any money on that? Because I'd like to get some of that action.
You're saying Warren is going to be out?
Yes.
By Michigan, she's going to be out.
That's my prediction.
Okay.
Well, hey, look at this now. Is she going to win Iowa? No. Is she going to win New Hampshire? No. Is she going to win South Carolina? No. Is she going to win Nevada? No. Okay, so you get all four of those done. She isn't going to win any of those. So then you get into Super Tuesday. So then what happens if she doesn't win in Super Tuesday? Then what's the point of her even being in at all? That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that Super Tuesday is going to flush her out just like Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete, he could win. I mean, is he going to win anything? I don't know if he's going to win anything. Doesn't look like it. So then why is he still in as well?
There's something to that, obviously. My question is, do you archive these shows and will you replay this?
All I know
by the time we get back.
Who did you say again were the four?
Sanders, Biden, Bloomberg, and Bennett.
No African-Americans and no women.
Correct.
Well, that'll be interesting.
Well, there's only one African-American still in, and he's going to be out after New Hampshire, I got to believe.
Yeah, I just think
it's South Carolina.
Does it make any difference how you time when you leave that you have a better shot for the VP spot? I guess that's the question.
Mm. Well, and that could be a Klobuchar thing, too, because I think she's vying for VP under a Biden ticket. I mean, does she leave after New Hampshire and then endorse Biden?
The bigger thing as far as Biden and VP is, I don't know if you saw the story, but apparently he would consider Michelle Obama as his running mate. Even if she isn't interested at all, as long as she doesn't say that and doesn't totally shut that door, that is a big, powerful tool for Biden. I'd heard that from some folks even prior to hearing about the story. But having her as a potential running mate would be a big one for Biden if he can make that stand up.
I don't know how that works because you're talking about an upside down ticket there. And traditionally, you better pick somebody who people don't think of as being quite to your level. I mean, the whole thing, we know who the vice president picks have been. So that's an interesting dynamic.
Well, I think in Democratic politics, I think Michelle Obama's name is at the top, or at least near the top, when it comes to people's popularity and who they really like. They really like Michelle Obama.
It was really interesting to see that floating out to the point where there was a story in the New York Times about it, because that combo could be very powerful with some key demographics within the Dem Party.
All right. Well, with that, let's talk to Sam here a little more about this ballot proposal that Progress Michigan has out. Where is Progress Michigan now on your ballot proposal to make a lot of changes to the way lobbying works here in the state?
Whenever you get headlines, you know, which Progress Michigan does sometimes with some of the things that we get up to, the comment section is sometimes the last place I want to look. I tell you, though, Kyle, after we filed, I went to the comment section and I was just shocked at how positive the comments were, with some people even saying, oh, this doesn't go far enough. You know, the comment section is really kind of translated into real life, you know, from behind the keyboard as well. Phone calls and emails from folks asking how they can get involved. A lot of support from organizations behind the scenes as we continue to kind of build this campaign. But we're excited, and we think that this is a popular concept, one that will make Michigan's government more work for the people, improve some of the abysmal, you know, lobbying laws and ethics and transparency policies we have here in the state. So, you know, we're expecting to go full bore with this thing forward.
So when do you hope to start collecting signatures? Because you have a 180-day window in which to collect them. And I imagine you are trying to connect with people right now to kind of get the ball rolling on this.
Yeah, so we have, we're expecting between now and February 21st for the Board of Canvassers to weigh in on the language and formatting of our proposal. And once that happens, we're going to get the ball rolling full steam ahead.
So is there a union group or a progressive group or any type of organization that has committed to either giving you money or volunteers to get this thing off the ground?
Stuff that we're continuing conversations with. We've gotten a lot of verbal support from organizations. This thing has kind of been moving in an interesting way because obviously the policy itself, there's a lot of new stuff in there. And we wanted to make sure that we had buy-in from various organizations before we actually filed. So we wanted to make sure that language was right. Progress Michigan's always down for an uphill battle. And especially with some of the support that we've got lining up behind this and the fact that we know it's a popular issue.
So the people who listen to this podcast may be a little nervous about the things that are in it. So why don't we go through and talk about what is actually in the proposal and maybe clear up any misconceptions someone might have.
Sure. So I guess I'll start off with, because I saw or I heard, some comments made about how this is to, prop up nonprofits as having more control in the state, or, folks like Rich Studley saying, oh, will this give unions another advantage? To be clear, there's no special carve-outs for anybody in this. This applies to all lobbyists, all organizations that use public communications to influence lawmakers, including Progress Michigan. So kind of broad strokes, what we're looking at is a mandatory two-year cooling off period before lawmakers, public officials can become lobbyists, a total gift ban between lobbyists, their clients, lawmakers, and their families, more public disclosure of public communications that try to influence lawmakers. So, the billboards that say, call Governor Whitmer and tell her X, Y, and Z, that sort of thing. And then a more robust lobbying reporting. So requiring monthly reports from lawmakers as well as lobbyists on when those types of interactions have taken place. Michigan has some of the worst ethics and transparency rankings in the entire country. We have, we've talked a lot about FOIA reform and gotten absolutely nothing, over the last I don't know how many years. This ballot proposal is a direct way for us to improve transparency in Michigan, ensure that lobbyists don't have an outside influence, and ending, frankly, what is legal bribery in a lot of cases with how this lobbyist and lawmaker relationship actually occurs.
On the total gift ban, do you see this as kind of a practical thing? I think it was asked at the press conference that this would include like even meals. I know right now there's kind of a threshold, but was there any consideration given to the threshold, or how do you see the practicality of not having any gifts of any value at all, including a meal for someone you're a client with?
Lobbyists can still make their case without buying something for the people that they are trying to influence. And that's where I say legal bribery. I don't know what else you would call it. And again, this idea of, a cup of coffee here, right? Or I'm buying you a sandwich. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, what, last year alone, there was nearly $600,000 spent on food and drinks in the first half of the year alone. And additionally, we've heard a lot of stories about not just the cup of coffee or the lunch here and there. It's here's the nosebleed ticket to the concert, right? But then once you get in, come up to our $10,000 suite. Enjoy the free buffet, enjoy the free booze. There's no other way to look at this when you have somebody who wants something and they're willing to spend money, give objects of value to somebody who has control over that decision-making process. There's no other way to look at it other than bribery. So let's just end the practice. People can still make their case. They can still have meetings. And guess what? They'll have to fill out a timesheet, just like a lot of other people in the world when they go out and do their work. They have to log hour by hour what they're doing, who they're meeting with. That's not out of, it's not some out of some crazy playbook. That's how regular people interact with their jobs every single day. Why should we not be expecting that from our lawmakers? Are being wined and dined to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars from a lobby corps that spends tens of millions of dollars increasingly every single year to influence them, and lawmakers have control over a billion-dollar budget. I don't think it's too much to say, you know what, just stick to the issues. No need to buy them that cup of coffee. They can buy their own.
So this goes to the Board of Canvassers when you get the language set. When are you thinking you're going to get out there and be collecting signatures?
Yeah, I would say anytime after, you know, as soon as the Board of Canvassers gives a sign off, we plan to hit the ground running. So probably late February.
Lobbyists, I suspect, are about as popular as a skin rash. So how long is it going to take you? 2 weeks to get these?
2 weeks might be, you know, if you've got a plan, Jack, to get us 500,000 signatures in 2 weeks, we should talk. No, it'll be an uphill battle.
That's easy. Get 500,000 circulators.
Sure. No, I mean, again, we've had, you know, conversations with a lot of organizations, with members who are supportive of this idea. We are doing, you know, our due diligence, going out and talking about the issue in front of, at meetings and community groups and things like that. And like you said, Jack, you know, lobbyists are not popular. And I understand that there's, you know, there are lobbyists on behalf of every single type of issue that you can think about, right? But again, this goes to, I think, the core of some of the fixing the problems in our government that people identify. You know, most people, folks outside of our bubble, see lobbyists and elected officials as corrupt, doing backroom deals, things like that. So why wouldn't they jump at the opportunity to clean Michigan government up a little bit?
Lobbying interests also probably have tens of thousands of dollars to spend against this campaign. They're probably going to spending against it to preserve their business model. Do you expect to see organized opposition during the signature gathering, or only during if you guys get it to the ballot and there's a campaign to do no? In addition to that, what messages are you expecting to counter from?
We'll have to see when that opposition actually comes. There's been the talk of, you know, well, there are free speech and free association issues with this. We've had legal minds look at this thing, and I don't think that there's anything wrong, again, with filling out a timesheet. Like, that's really kind of what we're talking about here. And again, these elected officials are employees of the people who elected them.
If I could interrupt for just a second here, though. Part of the problem with this thing, too, is that it could be compared to Reform Michigan Government Now, that initiative that was done back, I think it was 2006, where there was all this stuff that was packed into this ballot proposal. One could argue, hey, just take a look at this thing. This thing is a Trojan horse. Do you know what's in it? It's confusing. I mean, you could run into that problem.
I think it's pretty simple. I mean, should we have more transparency and accountability in government? Should lobbyists be able to legally bribe elected officials? Should lawmakers be able to, you know, leave office one day and the next walk right into, you know, being president of a massive business lobbying firm? You know, I think it's a pretty easy sell to people.
I think what Kyle's talking about is that got killed by the courts, because it had so many things, it was like an encyclopedia. I don't know that this doesn't sound to me like it's got as many moving parts as. The other thing that I would ask about this is because what we're seeing, for instance, with the voters, not politicians thing, is not fighting it in the election, but then trying to drag it through court forever afterward.
Sure. I mean, that's always a possibility, right? What I always say is the worst thing we can do is nothing. So you're not going to see Progress Michigan looking a year and a half ahead and saying, oh, well, you know, this could die in the courts. Like, hell no. Like, we're going to run forward with this thing because Michigan's government is broken and we have an opportunity to fix it. You know, one of the things that this can help do is provide a bridge to more transparency in the legislature and the governor's office and public university boards. I mean, across state government and public officials, we've been sitting on FOIA reform. FOIA reform hasn't happened, and this will finally provide us at least a small bit of a peek behind the curtain. If we at least know which lobbyists are meeting with which lawmakers and vice versa, that will make up for the dereliction of duty that has happened in the state Senate when it comes to FOIA, where, you know, 22 of the 38 state senators who are there right now have supported FOIA reform in the past, and yet it's not moving. Mike Shirky has held it up. So in the event of them not doing anything about actually making government more transparent in Michigan, we're going to do that.
Okay, and that kind of brings me to my last question that I had, which is the Senate and the House and Voters Not Politicians group has talked about getting together on a kind of comprehensive government reform plan that I think included a little bit of FOIA and maybe some lobbying disclosure and the revolving door and that type of thing. So if they actually move forward with something like this, would Progress Michigan pull the plug on your proposal?
We're planning on moving forward. We got our eyes on the prize on this one. You know, with some of the players involved, again, you know, Mike Shirky talking about transparency might sound good, but why is he sitting on FOIA then? I mean, they could pass this thing right now. We could have FOIA reform in Michigan this week if Mike Shirky had the political will to do it, but he doesn't. He's sitting on it. He's blocking it for whatever reason. Maybe there's something in, you know, emails that he doesn't want the public to see. Again, I just don't trust people like Mike Shirky, Rich Studley in the Chamber of Commerce to really be on board with good government reform because, frankly, they're the type of folks that had benefited from this broken system that we've had.
Have you picked up any allies? Like, to me, this is something that could cross over into, you know, not even necessarily progressive groups. There might be some other ones that would want to get on board with this one.
Yeah, we're talking with a litany of different organizations. You know, the Michigan Coalition for Fair and Transparent Elections joined us at the press conference. We've got some support from more of our traditional allies, and we're looking to build that coalition. One of the groups of folks that have reached out to us has been lobbyists. I mean, I've gotten messages from people saying, this is a great idea. What I have to do right now is a complete joke. This needs to change. We've had actual lobbyists reach out to us and say that this is a good idea.
Because you save their number for a TV ad, I hope, later.
No. Oh, you know, yeah. I'm always taking notes, Kyle. That's the old MERS person in me, you know.
All right. Well, Sam Englott, thanks for coming in here and sharing your knowledge on this ballot proposal. And what is it officially called? What's the name of it?
The Coalition to Close Lansing Loopholes.
Coalition to Close Lansing Loopholes. So it's CCLL.
You got it. Yeah, I'm a big fan of, you know, alliteration whenever I can get it in there. You know, shady shooty Lansing loopholes.
All right, thanks, Sam. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Chris DeWitt coming in a little earlier. Jack and Jacob, Sam, of course, AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.